The writer E.B. White once said, "I arise in the morning torn between a desire to improve the world and a desire to enjoy the world. This makes it hard to plan the day." I have seen this quote paraphrased as a need to decide whether to save the world or to savor it. These appear to be two distinct approaches, two opposite paths. So how shall you plan your day? Either you go for a hike across a rocky ridge and take in the sights, scents, and sounds of nature's grandeur, or you circulate a petition about saving the planet from the devastation of climate change. Either you indulge yourself at a restaurant with a delicious gourmet meal, or you go and serve meals at the homeless shelter. Either you make yourself comfortable by curling up with a good escapist mystery, or you volunteer at an after-school program to help teach a child to read. There are those who live their lives in one or another extreme on this continuum. On one end, those who are always saving the world, engaging in social activism, and helping others. And on the other end are those who are always savoring, enjoying what the world has to offer: nature, the arts, the creature comforts. Most of us live somewhere along this line, and our positions tend to shift at different times in our lives, or perhaps in different seasons. We may, for example, be very engaged in a particular project, say a political campaign, and that for a time puts us heavily in the save the world camp. Then perhaps we go on vacation and for a while we just enjoy ourselves by vegetating on a beach, camping in the wilderness, sightseeing. As many religious sages throughout the ages have said, balance is the key. Taking the middle path between extremes. This was, in fact, a basic message of the Buddha and also of Kung Fu Tzu, known in the West as Confucius. To live at either extreme of the save or savor continuum is to impoverish ourselves and to court burnout. Those who do nothing at all for others, who indulge themselves exclusively and treat the world as if it were a private playground, risk becoming bored with having only themselves and their private toys to play with. They ignore the innate tendency for compassion and caring and the human need to engage in something that transcends our lives. Ultimately, those who only savor may succumb to despair at what comes to feel like the emptiness of life. The remedy for this one is simple. There's a world out there. There are many needs, and there is never enough help. The prescription for the malady of too much self-preoccupation and indulgence is to turn your mirror into a window, to see the other and not just the self inside the glass. And then to reach out beyond the self and offer help. To become, even in a simple act of caring, an instrument of love. Giving service to others has sometimes proven to be a transformative experience. For instance, for those who are depressed, those who have experienced personal loss or tragedy, those who are beset with a loss of meaning, wayward and aimless teenagers, and others. Through serving other people, those who are troubled, challenged, or lost may discover that they indeed do have something to give the world. Those who devote themselves exclusively to saving the world through involvement with a myriad of causes and individuals in need, who never pause to renew themselves or take a deep breath between urgent and earnest campaigns. And I dare say that many of us in this room tend more toward this side of the save or saver continuum. While these save the world people are likely to become frustrated with the slow pace of social change or the recidivism of some they try to help who seem unwilling to make progress. Or perhaps they become frustrated with the inefficiency or disorganization of some of the groups they work with. The helper who wants to save the world may finally wonder if all of her or his efforts to help have been in vain. Eventually, the social activist or helper who takes no time to savor the world he or she is trying to save may become depleted and cynical. Some years ago, the columnist Anna Quinlan coined the phrase compassion fatigue, which she defined as the feeling of being overwhelmed by so many worthy causes and burned out trying to attend to them all. Quinlan's solution to keep compassion from turning into compassion fatigue is to keep sight of the people, the individuals in need, who are behind the great causes that people take on. She admits that this is easier for journalists than for many others, because she gets to interview the individuals behind the causes. As Quinlan says, when you meet a sweet and earnest 16-year-old who wants the baby but doesn't know what caring for one entails, you see something more than a problem. When you see a bright and funny 32-year-old man with AIDS who desperately wants to live to love again, you see something more than a problem. When you meet a man who lost his job and his family and wound up on the street and started drinking to forget how far he'd slid down the slope of humanity, you see something more than a problem. It's only when tragedy is personified, she says, that it becomes real. I would say that seeing causes as individuals may help with compassion fatigue when your compassion is spent on causes that don't bring you into direct contact with the people you help. But actually, it is quite possible and quite common for those who do get to help individuals one-to-one to also burn out, to lapse into compassion fatigue, as anyone in a helping profession will attest. Ram Dass and Paul Gorman, who wrote a book on helping called How Can I Help? Many years ago, devote a whole chapter to the burnout phenomenon. Their prescription for alleviating the burnout of the helper is to be able to step back from the situation, to become a dispassionate witness to your own efforts to help, to try to figure out what your own needs and expectations are, and then to try to let go of your need to have a particular outcome, or even to know the outcome. They point out that the helping situation, whether it's trying to save the world through social action or trying to care for an elderly parent, the helping situation is one that involves ambiguity, doubt, and uncertainty. If we can learn to accept not knowing, to embrace the ambiguity, then we can avoid the burnout that comes from doubt. Another way to avoid compassion fatigue, as Ram Dass and Gorman say, is to turn it into MASH. What they're referring to here is the TV series. You remember that old series set in the Vietnam, I'm not the Vietnam, it, It's kind of about, it was about Vietnam, actually, I mean undercover, but it was set in the Korean War. And in the MASH unit, doctors saw wounded coming out of the sky, out of helicopters daily, some of them screaming in pain. And they had to work really fast to heal these casualties under intense pressure with inadequate facilities and single-pointed concentration. But the rest of the time, they threw a party. They took the absurd and counterproductive aspects of the Korean War and used these as material for humor, for irony, for mischief, and irreverence. And these are what made the series so delightful and enduring, this comic relief that is living it up in the midst of serious tragedy and in the midst of that urgency of being a medical unit on the war front. Though Gorman and Ram Dass don't say it this way, the prescription for burnout in the MASH series is, in fact, to savor the world between intense periods of trying to save it, or at least save some of the individuals in it. In a speech given in the late 70s to environmentalists, the late author and eco-activist Edward Abbey advised, "Do not burn yourselves out. Be as I am, a reluctant enthusiast and part-time crusader. Be a half-hearted fanatic. Save the other half of yourselves for pleasure and adventure. It is not enough to fight for the West. It is even more important to enjoy it while you can, while it is still there. So get out," he said. "Ramble out yonder and explore the forests. Encounter the grizz. Climb a mountain. Bag the peaks. Run the rivers. Breathe deep of that yet sweet and elusive air. Sit quietly for a while and contemplate the precious stillness of the lovely, mysterious, and awesome space. Enjoy yourselves. If you take time to savor the world that you want to save, you will not only avoid compassion fatigue and have more energy for saving it, you may also develop a consciousness that will change the very nature of what saving the world means to you. It will not be mere service. It will become a sacred act, an act of reverence and gratitude. As Ram Dass and Gorman say, service is a journey of awakening. Through serving others, we begin to see the unity beneath diversity. The window turns back into a mirror. The helper and the helpee become one. You come to know yourself more deeply. The Hindu deity Hanuman, in making his offerings to the god Rama, says, "When I don't know who I am, I serve you. When I know who I am you." We've all had the experience, I would guess, of helping someone and suddenly seeing the world from that person's point of view, and then realizing that you and your helpee are not so very different after all, that your needs and wants and aspirations are similar, and that, in a sense, helping another is also helping yourself. Being a part of a congregation and attending regularly, as many of you here do, this means that you are thereby doing at least this much for yourself. You are, even if for just an hour a week, taking a Sabbath. In the mythic biblical story of Genesis, even God did it. After working so hard for 6 days to create the world, God took the seventh day to rest, to relax, and to admire, to savor the creation. I can almost hear that biblical God after the very first hard work week. Oy, that was a lot of work. Time to rest. This is a Mel Brooks kind of God that I sometimes hear in my head. I've been lucky enough to have a couple of friends in my life who have reminded me over the years of the value of Sabbath time. One has taken me to the countryside from time to time to enjoy nature. Another would call at unexpected times, urging me to drop everything and meet him for a movie. Another has had periodic needs for a spontaneous Scrabble game. None of them like to take no for an answer. We may need people in our lives who remind us to rest and play. Perhaps we can also serve that function in another person's life. In his book, Sabbath, Restoring the Sacred Rhythm of Rest, Wayne Muller speaks of the wisdom of taking a Sabbath, which is meant to be a time to refrain from work and action, to admire the creation just as it is. He writes, Sabbath is a time for sacred rest. It may be a holy day, the seventh day of the week as in the Jewish tradition, or the first day of the week as for Christians. But Sabbath time may also be a Sabbath afternoon, a Sabbath hour, a Sabbath walk, indeed anything that preserves a visceral experience of life-giving nourishment and rest. Sabbath time is time off the wheel, while we drink, if only for a few moments, from the fountain of rest and delight. You may remember that very popular book from quite a number of years ago called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. There is what for me has been a memorable reminder that's just inscribed. I think it's in the beginning of the book or on a front page, not really part of the book. It's a quote from a Japanese manual for assembling motorcycles, and it says simply, before assembling motorcycle, obtain peace of mind. I love that. Before assembling motorcycle, obtain peace of mind. Each day of our lives, there is a metaphorical, massive motorcycle in pieces before us, waiting to be put back together. It may be the broken motorcycle that is our needy and broken world, a world that cries out for our help, and we feel the call to act to try to save it. On some days, it may just be the unassembled motorcycle of things on our never-ending to-do list. Whatever it is that takes our time and fills our days, if we approach our tasks and commitments from a place of inner peace, our good work will be more effective. Put another way, to save the world most effectively, we need to take at least some time to savor it. Tomorrow is Leap Day, that odd extra day that we get every 4 years because there is an extra quarter day in each year, except on century leap days. It gets very complicated, but forget that. Mostly every 4 years we get a leap day. And for some reason, whenever a leap day comes around, I find myself thinking of it as a bonus day. It's a work day for most, but somehow feels like a bonus. Oh boy, here comes that extra day after 4 years of waiting. When I think about the leap day, I think it inspires me to take that opportunity to pause and savor the world as it is. This is a bonus. To pause and savor the world, even in all of its imperfection. to pause and experience gratitude for the gift of time that we have been given. So maybe we can think of tomorrow, Leap Day, as a special little gift. And really, all of our days are that. And perhaps sometime during Leap Day tomorrow, even if we're working as usual, we can take a personal Sabbath, an hour, a few minutes, even a moment, to pause in gratitude for this marvelous, marvelous gift, the gift of time, the gift of life, the gift of being. I'd like to end with a poignant quote that has been attributed to different people, even going back to the Buddha, but the Buddha would not have said it quite this way, I'm sure, although he did say it. It's a significant twist in a very common phrase. So I offer you this for your Leap Day tomorrow. Don't just do something, stand there.